And Evan Alexander is with us, Dr. Evan Alexander, Map of Heaven, and your phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Dr. Evan Alexander with us. We'll take your calls. Evan, we were talking about that little glimpse of heaven, why people have this little memory, and you wanted to finish it up with another point. Go ahead.
Well, I think the important thing is that this is something that we all know and remember. Of course, children, young children, are freshly in from that realm, and it's very common for them to have a very thin veil, as I say, that is, to have access, to realize that their spirits, say, of their soulmates, of spirit of their grandmother, grandfather, what have you, who have passed over, they're very aware, and they will play with them. And this is a very common observation. And then that veil gets covered up over time, and especially in our culture, where with our predominant views of materialism and the material being all there is, we tend to bury very deeply those memories of that much more real, eternal realm, the dwelling place of our souls. And so that is something that all souls remember, but they can be those memories can be quite deep. And I think that's why Proof of Heaven struck a chord, was it helped souls to remember what they knew to be true, and that eternity of souls and the divine connectedness of our souls is something that rings very true. And that's the kind of glimpse that that we can get with this, and we can get through deep meditation and centering prayer the very same thing, but we can cultivate thinning that veil very much so that with a prolonged lifelong practice of meditation, centering prayer, things like that, we can come to know that realm quite well. This is not something that's just for those who have near-death experiences or who actually die, but we can all, as conscious beings, come to cultivate and get more than just a fleeting glimpse of the reality of that realm.
Before we take calls, we talked a little bit about sacred acoustics. Why don't you explain that and how that works in meditation?
Okay, well, to me, one of the biggest shocks I had to deal with in explaining my experience was the fact that from that earthworm eye view, that very primitive state where it all began for me deep in coma, which was kind of a primitive, coarse, unresponsive realm, I was rescued from that by this slowly spinning white light that led up into that brilliant valley of ultra-reality and of everything vivid and alive and vibrant and constantly created into beauty. And where did all of that come from? I mean, the me before coma, the neuroscientist, would have said, well, wait a minute, the next step beyond the earthworm eye view is a state of no awareness at all. So how come it was like the blinders coming off in that very rich, ultra-real experience, which, of course, I came to realize many months later as I started reading the near-death literature is very, very common. More than 50% of near-death experiencers say exactly that about that ultra-reality. And so I thought, well, that is so paradoxical, of course, that as your brain is destroyed, that you become much more aware. And so I was looking for ways to try and model that and maybe reproduce it. And that's when, I guess it was about 2 years after my coma, I started finding out about the work of Robert Monroe. You know, that's all something I mentioned towards the end of Proof of Heaven, his out-of-body experiences, and all the wonderful work that Robert Monroe did over many decades because of those experiences. And he started thinking that sounds that he was listening to had given him the ability to have those out-of-body experiences. He ended up getting into something called binaural beats, and then he developed that into a program called HemiSync or hemispheric synchronization. The general idea is that if we present sounds of slightly different frequencies to the two ears, and say we do this through headphones so we can really isolate the two ears, say put a 100 hertz signal, 100 cycles per second signal into one ear and 104 cycles per second in the other ear, something very interesting happens. And this binaural beat phenomenon was first discovered in the mid-1800s by a German neurophysiologist, and the thing that happens is there's a circuit in the lower brainstem that measures the time of arrival of various pulses like that, and it calculates the difference between those two frequencies. So if we have 100 hertz in one ear, 104 hertz in the other, this very primitive circuit in the lower brainstem generates a 4 hertz signal, the arithmetic difference between them. It turns out that that region of the brain is also responsible, immediately adjacent to that timing circuit, is what's called the reticular activating system, which modern neuroscience, even though it knows very, very little about consciousness, it does postulate that the binding of consciousness, that is that sense of oneness, where all of these various neural modules, you know, vision and auditory and body awareness, all these things are bound into this sense of one conscious awareness. And modern neuroscience postulates that that comes from a timing circuit that basically unites in time all the various parts of the brain. It turns out that timing circuit is right next to this ignition circuit for consciousness. And that's what we're taking advantage of, I believe. Now, this is something that is still a long way from what I would call scientifically proven. We are working with groups to try and investigate this with sacred acoustics and how these tones work. But the group at Sacred Acoustics, and I do work quite closely with them, they have developed very enhanced forms of not only binaural beats, but using monaural beats and other ways to kind of drive those circuits in the lower brainstem in a way that I believe modulates the dominant electrochemical activity in the neocortex. So essentially, the simple way of putting this is that we're using these differential sound frequencies to the two ears to drive these low frequency modulations of the neocortex. And my idea about this is that it, in some sense, duplicates what was going on with my meningitis when I had severe destruction of my neocortex, is when my conscious awareness became so much greater. And I believe we're doing a similar thing with the sacred acoustics sounds and tones, by modulating the neocortical activity to allow for conscious awareness to go free. And in essence, we're kind of trying to take away the information processing of the neocortex. And by doing that in this very reversible and physiologic fashion, using differential sound frequencies, that's what allows conscious awareness to be set free from the shackles of the physical brain. Binaural beats were something that were used are found to be effective to enhance the states, even back during, you know, the remote viewing program, what was known to the lay public as, you know, the psychic spies, and various governments, the U.S., the Chinese, the Russians. I mean, everybody had remote viewers, and some of the work Monroe had done, and that the remote viewing programs had done, showed that in some people you might be able to enhance that remote viewing state with binaural beat technology. So this has a long history of using differential sounds to try and enhance conscious awareness, and especially non-local conscious awareness. And hence my work with Sacred Acoustics. I try to meditate an hour or two a day. I work with them very closely developing these tones. And these are available to everyone. People who are interested should go to sacredacoustics.com to learn more. I mean, the real essence of this is I believe that anyone who has a regular practice of meditation or of centering prayer, getting into consciousness and doing so in a way that we're able to quiet that voice in our head, because the voice in our head is not consciousness. Our consciousness is aware of that voice, but the little voice actually gets in the way of our much deeper and more expansive consciousness. And with these tones, with sacred acoustics, I believe that that brings tools to the world to help people to get into deep meditative states.
Okay, let's go to the phones now. Dale in St. Louis, first-time caller. Hi, Dale. Go ahead.
Yeah, George. Good morning.
Morning.
Dr. Evan.
Morning. Hello.
You with us?
Hello?
Yeah, Dale, go ahead.
Yes. Yeah, Dr. Evan, I was actually, I've been working on kind of a theory for a while about how heaven works, or, you know, how things work, and just listening to your experience, it actually sounds very similar to some of the things that I've been thinking about, and just really never have an avenue to really talk to anybody that's ever experienced it or whatever. But my thought has always been kind of that the early biblical writers might have only been writing from their own experience or their own knowledge. So when they were saying God or deity or something like that or heaven, that now that we have more of a scientific understanding, we might refer to it as, you know, a presence or an energy or a knowledge that exists maybe in another dimension, per se. And that the right. early biblical characters such as Jesus may have not have floated away into the sky, per se, but was actually more of a transdimensional being. And when the Apostle Paul talks about being taken in, he says, I don't know if I was in body or not, but I was taken to the third heaven and shown things and so on and so on. It sounds like he was taken into different realms. I've heard you use that term tonight several times. But it seems like maybe our consciousness and the little voice maybe exists in a non-corporeal realm, and that our bodies are almost like the physical hardware, that the software, like in cloud computing, can relate from this dimension through us, and that maybe when you had this experience, that you were taken to one of these realms and shown this in some way.
I think that's a very good way of looking at it, and that's really the point that I'm making in Map of Heaven, is this is about coming to understand a very real place. It's the home of our souls, and it's much more real than this world, and yet, you know, when we're incarnate in these physical forms, we're kind of stuck in this illusion of thinking that this little here and now and this little physical existence is really all that there is. But in fact, you've hit the nail on the head. It's it is something that is really all around us, all of where we are, because, again, it's coming to realize that the material world is the illusion. And that's a very crucial distinction. And certainly as you hear more and more people describe near-death and shared-death experiences, what they describe about the geometry and the shift of what happens around them, it points out that this is very much illusion. And I think what I often point out to my audiences is you've got to remember that as much as the science that I worship before tried to say that consciousness doesn't even exist, tried to just kind of define it out of existence, the truth of the matter is that consciousness is the only thing any one of us truly knows to exist, is our own consciousness. And also remind you that modern neuroscience would tell you that everything you've ever experienced since before you were born, I would say conventional neuroscience, every memory, every speck of awareness and experience you've ever had, they would try and tell you is just the flickering, electrochemical flickering of 100 billion neurons in a 3-pound gelatinous mass floating in a warm, dark bath. And of course, we think, no, wait, that's external reality. But no, everything you've ever experienced and know of and remember, according to that conventional neuroscience, is those electrochemical firing patterns of those neurons. It's not reality. It's a model of what we assume to be out there. And that, of course, is where quantum mechanics can be so illustrative, and yet also, if you're stuck in pure materialism, appears to be totally enigmatic. Is the fact that people, just like asking a fish what it's like to be in the water, and the fish says, well, what water? We might be tempted to say, if we're really stuck in materialist thinking, what consciousness are you talking about? You know, that's the real world out there. But one must recall it is truly a model going on within consciousness itself. And that's a crucial way of looking at this, especially if you're going to make the leap to the next level and realize the more fundamental nature of reality is that consciousness is the only thing that truly exists. In fact, I would say materialist science brings that beautiful gift to the table in pursuing some kind of unification of modern physics, say of relativity and quantum mechanics with quantum gravity or string theory or what have you, whatever the flavor du jour is of cosmology. is that there's no material to the material world. It's vibrating strings of energy in higher dimensional space-time. As Sir James Jean said in musing over the extreme mystery of quantum mechanics, the whole universe begins to look much more like a great thought than a great machine. Mind is the governor and creator of this realm. And I think that is the realization that's coming to science now, is a fundamental understanding of the importance of seeing the primary role of consciousness, of one consciousness, and in fact that would be something that we often experience as the divine, as that unconditional love of the creator, is that one consciousness existing at the fundament of all that is.
Were you more or less religious after your experience?
I would say I have become far, far more spiritual. And, you know, religion, I think religion can be a very great thing, but only when religion is based on our oneness and on love and on the connectedness of us all. When religion starts to put out dogma that says we're separate, that says we're in conflict, I think that that's when religion becomes very dangerous. And I'm very spiritual, and I fully support all the great religions of this world, insofar as they serve this purpose of connecting us to our true, divine, eternal, spiritual selves and foster that sense of love and connection and oneness. I often tell audiences, and I don't want to claim this, but I don't know who said it first, Christ was not a Christian, Buddha was not a Buddhist, Muhammad was not a Muslim, but they were all teachers teaching great love. And that's what this is all about, is coming back together and realizing this oneness that we all share. And that's what I see as the greatest advantage of this tremendous awakening in modern science and its binding with spirituality that is coming on us today, is that sense of oneness. So in that sense, you can say, yes, I'm quite religious, but I would clarify it in that fashion and say, yes, I'm very spiritual. And I had spent 8 years very agnostic before my coma, as I point out in the book.
Well, that would change it.
So this was a tremendous change.
Your website still lifebeyonddeath.net?
Actually, I've now converted just to ebenalexander.com.
Okay,
so
very good.
ebenalexander.com.
Super. And the book is available all over the place? The Map of Heaven?
Yeah, it should be out there everywhere. It's in many countries now. It's already being published around the world. So it should be available everywhere.
All right, we're going to come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM with Eben Alexander. We're going to take final phone calls here. And, of course, you can always email me at george@coasttocoastam.com. And also, don't forget to download our free apps for your smartphone. You can just get that at the coasttocoastam.com store or the iPhone or Android stores, the Google stores, and just pick it up. They are free. And don't forget also to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We'll be back in a moment. Those of you on hold, just hang where you are, right here on Coast to Coast AM, and we shall be right back. Tracking my calendar, if you would. Our next trip, of course, will be in Toronto on November 8th. Come on out and see us. You can get all that information by going to the calendar page at the bottom of coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back, and let's go to some final phone calls here. Let's go to Donna, Cottonwood, Arizona, to get things started. Donna, you're on with Dr. Eben Alexander. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I have a question for the doctor.
Sure thing.
I wondered whether, did your neocortex regenerate or what? Because obviously you wouldn't be functioning at this high level without a neocortex.
Well, that is an excellent question. That is one that haunted me for several years after my coma. My doctors to this day would tell you they have no explanation for how I had such a full recovery. In fact, my return, as I mentioned earlier, you know, when I first came back to this world, I had no words, no language, no memories of anything of my life before. And a lot of that came back, the words and language within hours and days and childhood memories and a lot of life memories over weeks and really all of more than 20 years spent studying neuroscience, all of that was back within about 8 weeks. And there was no ready explanation for that at all. I think I started seeing glimpses of an answer when I read a beautiful book by Anita Morjani. It's an NDE book. It's called Dying to Be Me. And she had a stage 4B non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, very severe illness. And by all rights, she should have just died within hours of her presentation to an emergency room. But she had a profound near-death experience, then ended up coming back to this world. And she did that knowing full well that her lymphoma would vanish, and that's what it did. Over a few days, these lymph nodes the size of lemons disappeared, and she is now completely cancer-free about 8 years later. And those kind of stories happen a lot in near-death experiences where we have healing that has no modern Western medical explanation. And I think therein lies kind of the deeper answer to your question. This is all about seeing illness or injury, disease, and health, and seeing it as that each and every one of us is not just a physical being and with mental and emotional health, but also very much a spiritual being and eternal spiritual beings. And so much of this is seeing the power that we have to heal. And that is something I often talk about in my talks, is that unconditional love does give us infinite power to heal. And that's where the power of prayer is so important to get. And it has to do with whether or not we can learn the lessons we are to learn from a given illness or injury in such a way that we can have healing within this incarnation. Then often that is something that's allowed. And so as far as I'm concerned, this is all really very much about healing at every level. And that a deeper awareness of this power of our consciousness, of soul, of spirit, over our existence can allow for what to modern medicine looks like miraculous healing.
Paul is in Seattle, Washington now. Go ahead, Paul. Thanks for calling.
Well, thanks, George. Hey, doctor. Hey, George.
Hi.
Okay, I'll make this kind of quick here. If the world is millions and billions of years old, and why does it seem to me that everybody who says they were reincarnated can only go back so far in history, like in the Civil War, backward? I mean, the Sumerians were like 7,000 years, and I never hear somebody, well, I used to be a Sumerian over here, you know. But anyway, I want to say real quickly, my Uncle Arnie, who passed away at 92 years old last month, just on the verge of dying, he had seen, and I agree with the doctor on some things, that when he was passing away, he saw my great-grandmother, he saw her. So I agree with the doctor that when you're starting to pass away, that you're just actually opening up another life. But let me just say this, that, I believe also, doctor, that we're being oppressed as far as our spiritual mind. I think we could do a lot more right now without having to be reincarnated. I think our minds are I think we can move things with our mind, for example. I think we can fly, things like that. But let me just say that when I'm paraphrasing this, when the Pharisees asked Jesus, by what authority do you do these miracles? He said, my father showed me these things. And I'm not preaching. I'm just saying, well, his father showed him something that I think that we might have the knowledge right now. I think that he showed us some, so he showed us how to do it.
Well, you promised that you were going to be quick, so so let me get into this.
Well, I would just say, to kind of get back to your original question, I've heard plenty of stories of reincarnation that go far, far back beyond the epochs you described. And not only that, they're not limited to to Earth. I mean, this is something that is far bigger than all of that. And I've heard amazing stories of kind of reincarnation and past memories and that kind of thing. So I would not say that it's limited to very recent times, as you were pointing out.
Evan, the one thing about reincarnation, I mean, some people have gone back as far as Atlantis. That's 30,000 years ago, maybe.
Yes, exactly. That's where a lot of that information comes from.
Well, I'm losing you on the phone. Where'd you go?
Oh, there I am.
There you go.
Still here.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, but I'd say you're exactly right. That's where a lot of that kind of information has come from, is through these kind of reincarnation memories.
Let's go to Cade in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Cade, good morning to you.
Hey, morning to you. It's a pleasure. I have two quick questions for you.
Sure.
One of them is, what do you think exactly is God's intent for near-death experiences? Like, why do some people have them? And why do some people not have them? And another one is, are there any documented near-death experiences related to hell? Seems like most people think see heaven, but I was wondering if there's...
Yes. Two very, very good questions. The general figure out there in the near-death literature is somewhere between 15 and maybe 25% of people having what qualify as near-death memories when they come back. I think the real number is probably higher than that. Got to remember that for a lot of this, the recent decades, people did not volunteer these things. People would have profound experiences. I still have people come up to me a lot after I give talks and say, I never told anybody this, but. And then they'll tell me a story of, it might be a very profound and detailed story of a near-death experience they had 40 or 50 years ago. That's the other interesting thing, is the memories do not fade. These are not dreams, hallucinations, drug effects, confabulations. These memories are very profound. They change people's lives, and they do not fade. That was something that's shocking about my own experience. I was very worried because initially I was treating it all as some crazy, wild trick of the brain, and I thought they would fade away. Well, they don't fade at all. These memories persist. But the interesting thing is that probably the number is higher than that just because they're underreported. And, I don't know why everybody doesn't have them, but that's the case. But they're still plenty common, if they're in 25 or 30 or 35% of people. And I'm sorry, your second question was about, was that again?
How many people out there have near-death experiences?
Oh, yes, the hellish NDEs. Well, if I had just gone to the Earthworm's Eye View and spent time there and then come back to this world, I would have had a hellish NDE. They are very much in the minority of probably about 2 or 3% are hellish. Now, my own feeling about that, my own belief, is that the hellish ones are incomplete. In other words, just as if I had returned kind of prematurely from Earthworm's Eye View, I would have had a hellish NDE. I believe as people go through more complete experiences, they inevitably encounter more of the incredibly idyllic, beautiful, pleasant, all-loving and comforting, blissful NDEs that are so often talked about.
One or two more calls.
And there is, to answer your question, a small number of documented kind of hellish NDEs. But in my view, they really are just incomplete.
What about the devil? Do you believe in the devil?
I do not. I mean, my feeling is that evil and darkness are really the lack of that love and that light and that infinite healing power of unconditional love. And I do not believe that there is a conscious agent of evil and darkness that works against God the Creator. And it's really because I see all of this and that loving God is the creative source. And by being the creative source, it is really all about that love. Now, of course, when you get deeply into cycles in the universe in the larger scale, and this goes back to some of the Eastern teachings, of course, you also had destructive forces, but they were something that was blended with the creative force in a way that allowed for the whole thing to be seen more as an ongoing creative process. So, no, I do not believe that there is a devil out there fully opposing as a pure darkness and evil against those forces of light and the love of that God.
It's Ray now in Niles, Ohio. Ray, you are up. Go ahead.
Good evening. I, too, have come to the conclusion that the emergent property view of science is very likely false. I want to present a philosophical argument to support that and see what your guest thinks of it. Now, when I use the pronoun you, I'm referring to a locus of experience. All of us are vantage points from which we perceive the world. We're vantage points peering out of a body. Okay, each one of us is a certain vantage point
sure.
of the world. And then let's refer to a quote from Blaise Pascal, who said, I'm astonished that I find myself here rather than there, now rather than then. Now, why is that astonishing? Well, let's do a thought experiment and imagine all of the billions of bodies that have ever been born. Now, if we try to distribute physical properties across these bodies, there's no problem. In other words, if we say, which one of these bodies is going to have blonde hair, which is going to have brown hair, which is going to have green eyes, which is going to have blue eyes, which is going to have light skin, which is going to have dark skin, we can do that. We can go into the DNA of that body, find a gene for that, and we can explain why each body has a certain physical characteristic. We can do the same with diseases. But now let's try the same thing with the vantage point, and all of a sudden we fall apart. In other words, if we ask in which body, say, is George Norrie's first-person vantage point going to emerge, now we've got a serious problem. We can't say, well, this body has something unique in it that no other body has had, and that's the George Norrie first-person awareness gene, but surely that's preposterous. There is no such thing. Now we've got a problem because science requires that the instance of any state of affairs or event is the consequence of some law-like regularity. Well, we can't predict where you're going to emerge. And the reason we can't even do that in principle, and the reason why we can't do it is not because we don't know enough, it's because there's nothing to know. There's no way you can instantiate. See, if the emergent property view is correct, it would make sense in principle to predict where a person's emergence. In other words, why isn't George Norrie's vantage point, why didn't that emerge in the body of Alexander the Great or Julius Caesar or Napoleon or, heaven forbid, Charlie Manson?
Well, how do you know it didn't, though? That's the question.
Right, and I would say that it really, you're getting at a very interesting question that has to do with boundaries of self. Which I think have to be questioned. One has to step way up and outside of all this. Just to give you an example of what I'm talking about, I love Jill Bolte Taylor's book, My Stroke of Insight. She had a vascular malformation right in the middle of Wernicke's area, which is the receptive speech area in the brain. And as it destroyed her receptive speech area, that's where we form all of our definitions and boundaries, she started becoming one with the desk, the chair, the rug, the room, feeling this overwhelming sense of love and oneness with all that she was aware of. And I think that's an important point of this consciousness. We have this illusion of self and this illusion of being contained within, the one body. But in fact, there's plenty of work, especially in some of this modern science of non-local consciousness, that shows you really have to question what those boundaries are. There's a lot of kind of overlap of conscious awareness and of soul and spirit. I mean, there are cases where people have dreamed other people's dreams and things like that. It's consciousness is something that at various levels starts to lose those boundaries. And that's part of the real magic of it. And I think that's where a lot of the current science, especially as it evolves and we learn more about this, is going to reveal incredible powers of our mind and of consciousness to go out and know things far beyond the ken and influence things far beyond the ken of our physical senses. So really those notions of self really are called into question and investigated, and you find that we are much more than these physical bodies restricted to this local here and now.
Do you fear death now?
No. I realize death is an adventure. It's a transition. It's actually an awakening to a much higher level of consciousness. I'm not in a big hurry to make it happen, but on the other hand, when it does happen, that's fine. That's part of my journey. That's part of our transition. I know that my soul lives on, that my connectedness to my loved ones lives on. Our soul groups do not end with the death of physical bodies. Our whole soul group will be back working together, at other times. So the death of the physical body, it's, as Shakespeare said, all the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players. In some way, that's it. This material realm, this soul school, is the stage on which the drama unfolds. And when this act of the play is over, I discard this costume, reunite with my higher soul and soulmates, and we plan the next incarnation. Don't get too attached to these physical bodies. And again, that's one of the gifts that material science in the front edges of cosmology and physics brings to the table, is the statement that there really is no material to the material world. It is all a great thought and a beautiful, cleverly wrought illusion.
What's the greatest message? What's the greatest message we can take from your experience?
The greatest message is that we are all truly eternal spiritual beings, deeply loved by the divine infinite power of that God, that creative source, and that we're all in this together. And anytime we hurt others, we're hurting ourselves. And the more this world can come to realize that this is absolutely built in the fabric of our very existence, this love and caring and taking care of others and of ourselves, loving ourselves first and foremost, which I think is the root of so many of the world's problems, that we don't even truly love ourselves enough as those infinite and infinitely powerful divine spiritual beings. And the more we can all come to knowing this, the better a place this world will be.
Eben, thank you for spending a couple hours with us. You keep in touch, okay?
Well, George, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Dr. Eben Alexander, all his information, you've got it at coasttocoastam.com. For Dan Galante, Will Wilkerson, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.